to hashish to psychedelic substances. But above all, Europeans are the world's biggest consumer of heroin. Europe is a lucrative market for illegal drugs. Most of the 88 tons of heroin consumed in the continent originates from the Golden Crescent, the space between southern Afghanistan and northern Pakistan. The area where NATO troops are fighting the Taliban. The area home to the world's biggest poppy and hashish fields. Afghanistan is the world's biggest producer of opium and heroin. Of the 380 tons of heroin produced in the country every year, 26% is smuggled into Europe, 21% to the Russian Federation, and the rest to other countries. The Balkans remain the main route for smuggling drugs into Europe from Afghanistan. Traffickers use it at any cost because it's shorter and involves a 1,845 kilometer border between Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan.
It will be a difficult situation, I must say. It will be a very difficult situation, not only for Iran, but for going to the Europe or Africa.
The Balkan route traverses Iran, Turkey, Greece, and Bulgaria across Southeast Europe to the Western European market. Iranian guards are at constant war on the country's eastern borders with Afghan and Pakistani smugglers. And on the front line of the combat to prevent illicit drugs from making it to Europe is Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province. Despite that, the drugs make it through because there's a lot of money involved, and those who are in it for the money are prepared to risk their lives for it. A 6,000-year-old land southeast of Iran, with a kind, hard-working people and a rich culture. The creator of the world's first painted pottery in the 3rd millennium BC. Because it's on the Golden Crescent, the illicit drugs trade has imposed an unwanted war upon it.
From 2012 to 2013, crop eradication programs decreased 24% compared with the previous year. And currently, the profit generated by drug trade is more than Afghanistan's state budget, a fact contributing to the spread of corruption to all levels of the Afghan government, from the police to parliament.
Because of the transition situation in Afghanistan, the Afghan government's has not been able to fully focus on the drug issue because right now the Afghan government has been busy and preoccupied with the security transition, with economic transition, and with political transition.
As long as the central government remains too weak to improve security in the country, the areas under cultivation would generate huge profit for the drug traffickers. In her recent survey, German researcher Sita Maas suggests that in order to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan, all the politicians involved in the anti-narcotics campaign must be dismissed from their political posts.
As you know, I could not attend your last hearing because I was in Afghanistan, where there are high hopes for a successful election, bolstered by a stronger than expected showing of the Afghan military over the last several months. Yet this optimism is tempered with depressing evidence of persistent corruption, continued wasteful spending, and increased violence.
John F. Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, believes that the Afghan government must have the political will to combat narcotics, what it is devoid of.
As with the question of the drug, corruption is a multifaceted challenge and problem. So if we tackle the corruption in Afghanistan, it will produce dividend in our ability to tackle the drug issue. So the two are interconnected, as also the question of terrorism, also is another interconnected factors with the drug and with the corruption.
Perhaps the best way to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan is to steer farmers away from drug trade towards alternative, legitimate crops like grapes, wheat, and saffron. Spraying poppy fields is also suggested as another available option for disrupting Afghanistan's lucrative opium market, though chemical spraying has never worked in the Golden Crescent. Experts believe that it is lax security in Afghanistan that gives the Taliban a free rein to cultivate poppies and smuggle drugs.
One important reason for the both the production and the consumption of the drug is the question of poverty. Poverty provides the context, the excuse, and the attractiveness for some farmers in Afghanistan.
The majority of Afghan farmers work for big landlords, and the meager wages they earn are barely enough to get by. What's more, the lack of other viable options makes them work on poppy fields. Some farmers even have to marry their young daughters to their debtors. Opium trade accounts for 35% of Afghanistan's GDP. Against such a backdrop, poppy crop eradication is just chasing a mirage.
This is actually taking your face away from the reality because they are attacking some other targets for insurgencies and Islamicism and things like that. And international forces, when I talk to them, they say our mandate is not poppy eradication. Our mandate is fight against terrorism. So we will fight against terrorism. They will not touch the farmers or things like that. He said this is not our mandate.
Needless to say, it's a challenging task to close a Pandora's box of poppy cultivation, opium production, heroin processing labs, and drug trafficking. No doubt poppy cultivation is done inside Afghanistan, but heroin processing equipment cannot be manufactured there. It's no secret that NATO forces in the Golden Crescent turn a blind eye on farmers' activities, at least not to make enemies out of them.
Many people were worried that that if international community leaves Afghanistan, there might be a vacuum, there might be a civil war. Therefore, some farmers, mafias, they took advantage of that uncertainty and increased their production.
Experts say that opium production and export have increased considerably since the fall of the Taliban. Foreign forces in collusion with the Taliban have facilitated poppy cultivation and opium production and export to make drug trade in Afghanistan the main source of income for some countries in the world. It's not possible to export such a huge amount of drug from Afghanistan without the involvement of state officials, foreign forces, and international networks. On the 11th of December 2010, the New York Times published an article on the relationship between the United States government and drug lords like Juma Khan. As the biggest and most dangerous drug lord in Afghanistan, Juma Khan was arrested and transported to New York to face charges under a new American narco-terrorism law in 2008. That's while Mr. Juma was a longtime American informer who provided information about the Taliban, Afghan corruption, and other drug traffickers. Along the way, he was also paid a large amount of cash by the United States. According to the article, in his heyday, Mr. Juma Khan was secretly flown to Washington for a series of clandestine meetings with CIA and DEA officials in 2006. John F. Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, has confessed that the international community has failed in reducing poppy cultivation in Afghanistan and in cutting the Taliban off the drug money. Likewise, U.S. officials believe that they have not been successful in combating narcotics in Afghanistan, in spite of the $7 billion budget they spent for this purpose. American experts estimate that the Taliban might have received around $360 million over the past decade. European countries are the biggest consumers of Afghan-produced heroin. Narcotics production in Afghanistan is growing at an alarming rate. Apart from the local Afghans, people in neighboring countries and those located on the transit route used for smuggling those drugs to Europe are affected. Iran shares the longest border with Afghanistan and is the first country on the transit route to Europe. And as a result, it has incurred huge human and financial costs. Iran is at the forefront of a full-scale war against drugs destined for Europe. The more the drugs produced in Afghanistan, the more difficult the job for Iran, and the more the perils against the security of Europe. It's a vicious cycle. Drug trafficking gives rise to terrorist groups. Terrorist groups create insecurity. Insecurity leads to an increase in the trafficking of narcotics. And narcotics swell the coffers of terrorist cells.
I personally believe there is a very strong linkage that the money related to drug is used for terrorism. If for a terrorism, you need billions of dollars to buy equipment, to pay for the people and things like that. So somebody is supporting them.
An all-out war. A war spanning Iran's eastern borders, next to a beautiful ancient land. Afghan drugs have to make it to the lucrative European markets. Millions of euros are involved. On the length of Iran's eastern borders, large embankments that run many kilometers, multi-layered barbed wire fences, massive concrete walls, hundreds of security cameras, advanced tracking systems, trained guards, and a concrete wall. Chabahar Port, Iran's only gateway to an ocean, sharing a 300-kilometer maritime border with the Gulf of Oman. A beautiful city with warm-hearted people whose only means of livelihood is maritime transport and fishing. A peaceful life that's become a target of traffickers. Another route, another insecurity, war on another front, the lull before the storm.
This cannot be solved before problems in Afghanistan find a solution. The other measures, police measures, certainly have to occur, but I fear that there will be no real change before the situation in Afghanistan can change, and there will be a solution also for all these farmers who are producing, who are living on the poppy seeds.
Narcotics production in Afghanistan continues unabated. Steadily, and with no obstacles. The drugs produced in Afghanistan are transited to Europe via different routes. One route used for transiting heroin traverses Iran and Turkey before getting to Europe. Another spans countries in Central Asia and the Russian Federation. And the third one starts in Pakistan, continues into the sea, leading to Arab countries, China and Africa, and eventually Europe. But the shortest of these paths is the so-called Balkan route, with Iran at its very mouth, the front line of the war against the traffickers. Despite all the controls in place, part of the narcotics cargo makes it past the Iranian border. The war has to be taken to impassable mountain tracks, gorges, and paved roads. There is no end to the war on the eastern borders. The traffickers possess heavy, high-tech weaponry. Their financial and human losses are quickly replenished. Drug money, poverty, and insecurity along the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan provide them with an inexhaustible resource. The last battleground is the western borders. The same precision, the same discipline, the same war, all to prevent the drugs from reaching Europe. 4,000 martyrs, 12,000 wounded during an ongoing 35-year war against the drug traffickers. Who's going to answer to the victims' families? Why should Iran be at the forefront of the combat on Afghan drugs bound for Europe? Why should Iran make the biggest heroin bust in the world? Why should Iran pay the price for NATO and the Afghan government's ineptitude in fighting drug production? What motivation should the Iranian soldier have to stand up against the smuggler's bullets so that Afghan-made heroin doesn't make it to Europe? If Iran gives up the war on drugs, how will Europe deal with the aftermath?
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is related to one of the beautiful surahs of the Holy Quran, and that is the last surah of the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nas. In Surah An-Nas, God Almighty refers to himself using three beautiful attributes or sifats. The first is Rabbin Nas, the Lord of men. Secondly is Malikin Nas, the Sovereign and King of men. And finally is Ilahin Nas, or the object of worship of men, right? So the question we want to ask today is, why is it that God Almighty has referred to himself using these three titles or these three attributes, these three sifats? So the reason for this is that human beings naturally, when they're faced with any danger, they seek refuge in a being or in something that can repel that danger from them, right? The danger in this surah that's mentioned and is referred to is the danger of the insinuations of the devil, right? So human beings, obviously, they're naturally religious. They're naturally directed and oriented towards God, right? And religion is something natural to man. This is a kind of a Quranic concept that we believe in as Muslims, right? So there has to be an external force, right, which kind of misguides man and leads him astray from this right path that he naturally walks upon, right? Unless if there's no agitation, right, and there's no, no wind. If you wanted to compare, give an example for this, we can say that imagine a lake, right? A lake, it naturally, if it's unagitated, there's no external force that kind of agitates it, a wind or something thrown into the river, and no ripple is created within the river. That river naturally reflects the sky and the stars in the sky, right? If left unagitated, right? But if something, an external force comes and kind of agitates it, right, and creates ripples or waves in it, it's not going to reflect, you know, the heavens. Right? Something similar to this is the soul of man, right? Left unaffected by an external force, right? Then this soul, right, is like a mirror that kind of reflects God, right? But if something agitates it from the outside, now when we see outside here, right, it doesn't necessarily mean something outside of man, right? Outside of man. It could be one of his lower faculties, right? Which aren't technically outside of his being, but outside of, we could say maybe outside of his higher divine nature, right? Right, so we seek refuge in God Almighty from these external forces that can agitate us and not allow us to preserve our primordial nature. Why is it that we seek refuge in God? Because he is the Rabbun Nas, because he is the Lord of men, right? Meaning he's the being that nourishes man, right? Because he is the Lord of man and he nourishes man, right? He has the ability to repel this danger from us, and it is his function to do so. Now, you know that in the Holy Quran, God Almighty refers to himself in many places as Rabbul Alameen, the Lord of all of the worlds, right? But he doesn't refer to himself as Rabbul Alameen here, the Lord of the Worlds. Rather, he refers to himself as Rabbul Nas. Because right now, in the verse in question, right, because he's speaking about a problem which is related directly to man, right, being Rabbul Alameen is not really pertinent per se here. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the first three verses of Surah An-Nas. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Jerome Powell, the chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, has often expressed admiration for the resolve exhibited by one of his predecessors, Paul Volcker, who was willing to crash the economy in the early 1980s to drive down inflation. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, The Courage Required to Confront Inflation. Jerome Powell, the chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, has often expressed admiration for the resolve exhibited by one of its predecessors, Paul Volcker, who was willing to crash the economy in the early 1980s to drive down inflation. Inflation in the United States is now higher than at any time since Paul Volcker's recession, and Jerome Powell faces growing calls for the U.S. Federal Reserve to emulate that resolute performance and do whatever is necessary to control inflation, even if it hurts economic growth. The present moment requires a different kind of courage. Instead of reprising Mr. Volcker's shock and awe tactics, the U.S. Federal Reserve needs to pursue a more measured approach, one that would bring inflation under control without sending the economy into a deep recession. There is a risk that by foregoing stronger measures now, the Fed will ultimately have to impose greater pain. But there are also good reasons to think that the U.S. Federal Reserve can succeed, not least because of the enduring legacy of Paul Volcker's achievement. The U.S. Federal Reserve already has begun to shut down the stimulus campaign that it launched in the spring of 2020 to limit the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. The central bank raised its benchmark interest rate at its recent policymaking meeting in March by a quarter of a percentage point to a range between 0.25 points and 0.5 points. It is widely expected to accelerate this process by announcing on Wednesday an unusual half percentage point increase in the benchmark rate, and by announcing that it will begin to reduce the bond holdings that it amassed to further suppress borrowing costs. It is time to raise interest rates. The U.S. economy has rebounded as COVID-19 has loosened its grip, notwithstanding the quirky weakness of reported economic growth in the first quarter of 2022. Inflation is now the primary economic problem confronting the United States. Prices are outpacing wage growth for most Americans, eroding their living standards, and higher interest rates will help to slow rising prices. The U.S. Federal Reserve's benchmark interest rates would need to rise to somewhere between 2% and 3% to reach a level at which it is neither stimulating nor restraining economic growth. Some Fed officials and outside economists have argued for additional half a percentage point moves in the coming months. Some already are convinced the U.S. Federal Reserve will need to raise interest rates well above the neutral level to break inflation. Under Paul Volcker, the rate hit 20%. Jerome Powell, to his credit, has maintained a more measured tone. He said recently it was time for the Fed to move a little more quickly. One reason to go slowly is that it takes time to judge the impact of changes in U.S. Federal Reserve policy. Merely by signaling that it plans to raise interest rates, the Fed already has initiated a significant reaction in financial markets. Average interest rates on home mortgages, for example, have climbed sharply. The monthly mortgage payment required to buy a median-priced home has increased to $1,690 from less than $1,165 a year ago, according to Robert Perley, the head of the Global Policy Research at the investment bank Piper Sandler. Another reason for caution, economists continue to debate the causes of the current inflation. Some place the blame primarily on the pandemic, which has caused sharp reductions in the availability of services and goods, driving up prices. With new vehicles in short supply, for example, used vehicle prices rose by more than 50% throughout January. More recently, the conflict in Ukraine has disrupted global markets for energy and wheat, driving up the prices of gasoline and food in many parts of the world. Other economists, however, regard the federal government's response to the pandemic as the key factor. On top of the U.S. Federal Reserve's efforts to lower borrowing costs, Congress distributed trillions of dollars in aid. Despite widespread job losses, the average household had more money to spend, creating more demand for goods and services. Here's why the difference matters. The central bank's decision to raise interest rates can curb demand. Supply shortages, on the other hand, are best endured patiently. The US Federal Reserve's decision in the week ahead won't ease them. Lingering questions about the health of the economy provide another reason for the Fed to move cautiously. A goal of the U.S. Federal Reserve's stimulus campaign was to return the economy to full employment, meaning that those who wanted work would be able to find it. By one popular measure, the unemployment rate, which sits at the low level of 3.6%, the U.S. Federal Reserve has succeeded, prompting some to question the need for continued stimulus. But the government's definition of unemployment is narrow. It includes only people actively seeking work, while many Americans remain on the sidelines. About 1.6 million fewer people are working now compared with early 2020. In the 1970s, workers successfully demanded wage increases to compensate for expected increases in prices, while employers raised prices to cover the expected cost of higher wages. This dynamic, which economists call a wage-price spiral, can be dangerously self-perpetuating. But in the intervening decades, American workers have suffered a significant loss in their bargaining power. While many businesses say they are struggling to find enough workers, that has not translated into real wage gains for employees. Businesses are raising prices much faster than they are raising wages, allowing them to reap record profits. While inflation is up by 8.5% over the past year, wages for private sector workers are up by just 5%. In other words, there is no evidence the United States is entering a wage-price spiral. Finally, Jerome Powell can afford to move more cautiously because Paul Volcker and his successors convinced the American public and global investors that the Fed is committed to controlling inflation. Mr. Volcker once told an interviewer that he wore a path in his rug by pacing back and forth, wondering whether the pain he was imposing would accomplish that goal. It was a victory won at a high cost. Moving too quickly to confront inflation or raise interest rates too high would squander it.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the solutions of your problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Well, today to provide you with those very beautiful tips based on Quran and narrations, we have with us in the studio our guest speaker, who is a world-famous speaker and Islamic researcher. Yes, she is none other, Razia Batul Najafi. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me here in this beautiful discussion.
Thank you so much for coming, despite your busy schedule. Well, sister, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about that who is responsible for the education, for the upbringing of children. And in that session, we came to know it's not just parents. Schools, in fact, play a very important role, and even friends, family, society, everything has some role to play. So parents do have roles. We have been talking about that, and we talk about that in our sessions regularly. But today, I would want you to tell us something about the schools. What is the role played by the schools in Islamic upbringing?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we all know that half of our life, you know, during our student life, we spend in our schools.
Yes.
So definitely, no doubt, no one can deny the very crucial role of schooling and education and the environment of school and teachers and friends on our children.
Yeah.
So the first thing is that we have to be very, very sensitive about the choosing the school.
All right.
And I have seen in many European countries that literally parents, first they go and they visit and they talk to the management and principal, that these are our principles and these are our like rulings and culture.
Yeah.
So if you truly accept this culture, means whatever is acceptable, whatever is easily, you know, they can practice during the school time. So you can't believe it, Sister Zainab. Most of the time, in most of the schools, they truly appreciate, they respect the rulings. Like rulings are mostly what? Like modest dressing, for example.
Yes,
you know.
Yes.
So if anyone is like the uniform is maybe the mini skirt, so you are asking for full skirt, for example.
Yes.
You know, half sleeves, you are asking for full sleeves, for example.
Yeah.
You know, and if the kids have any music session class, they are asking that this kind of music, no, but that kind of halal music, yes, you know. So little here and there, and you can't believe it nowadays, especially day by day, because Islam as a beautiful, comprehensive religion, you know, it's not like before. People are respecting more, although we have the problems more. Islamophobia is there too, but still many people, they are respecting the Islamic rulings. So the first step is how to choose
a school.
And the involvement of parents with the management of the school.
All right. So the first thing was to choose schools. We will definitely talk on that after a very short break. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing, and we are talking about the role played by schools in Islamic upbringing. Sister Najafi, you said the first and the foremost thing in the role that school plays is the selection of school done by parents. And the parents tell their conditions to the schools, like if there's a Muslim parent, it tells the school that I don't want my child to wear half sleeves, half skirts, or I don't want my child to be without hijab. So parents, by talking to the administration, can change these rules for their own kids.
Oh, yeah. Because mostly Muslim community, they live somehow near to each other.
Yeah.
So rarely you will find someone because of some restriction or some big need, they move to the city where there's no Muslim, even no single Muslim in that school. You know, that happens really. Mostly people, they love to move to the city or to the sector where the most of the people are maybe, you know, Muslims.
There's a mixed culture.
Yeah, exactly. So you will get some Muslims there. So most of the parents, if they're worried, you know, if they show their worries towards the Islamic culture, then they can solve very easily. I will give you some examples.
Yeah.
Like our Ahle Sunnah wal Jama'ah community, they are very active in school, college, universities. So literally they go and they request for a prayer room and even maybe any corner and break for prayer times. So if 20 of students, they are going together and asking for this, so mostly in the West, they truly respect the human rights, especially in this educational areas, you know, centers.
Yeah.
So you will get your right because you are, you know, maybe half of the class or maybe half of the, you know, like big
school,
number of,
yeah.
So we have many ways, you know, so it shows, alhamdulillah, because the question came from the parents, that means they are worried.
They are concerned.
Thinking about their children's future and akhirah and hereafter. That means a lot. Now, first step is to be in touch with the management. Just not only look at the brand of the name of the school and the area and the just, you know, admit your child in that school. No,
yeah.
First you can go and you can talk in a very nice, you know, and mannerly. And even you can be the big influential for them. They would be impressed by your seriousness and by your, you know, like strict...
Maybe the logic you provide for having the Islamic dressing.
Oh, yeah. I remember one mother, she has given this example of tie, yeah? So they have this objection that, you know, when kids are in the lab,
mm-hmm.
So sometimes, you know, they play with some fires and some very, like...
So it could be dangerous.
Exactly. So if the girl is wearing the scarf,
mm-hmm.
So that would be not, you know, safe for her.
Right.
So parents, they have done some research about that, how our hairs can catch fire more quicker than a piece of clothes.
Yeah.
And the tie, and they were so amazed by the examples and logic of
and the
parents.
Logic behind it, obviously.
Yeah.
I'll be talking to you after a very short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
يَا مُطِيَ الْخَيْرَاتِ يَا مُطِيَ الْخَيْرَاتِ.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIV English Radio. We are talking on Islamic upbringing and the role played by the schools. So, Sister Najafi, you said parents need to talk, they need to choose wisely, not by looking at what my neighbor selected for his children. I'll also do the competition to just admit in my child in some very expensive school, not looking at the conditions and terms. You said we should be serious. Talking to the administration, the first and foremost thing is that we need to be in touch with the management.
Definitely. And the second thing, which is really important too, is that if anything happens to your child and he or she comes and tells you that, you know, maybe because of opposite gender, you know, I feel some kind of crush or attraction, mom, because I'm going to this kind of school.
A co-education.
Yeah, because
right.
of co-education. So we as a parents, we have to be very cool and calm and peaceful, and we should know how to listen to them. Whatever right. happens, yeah. You know, like, you should be like a beautiful tree full of oxygen. If you just, you know, early in the morning, if you go near those beautiful green areas and you're just taking all those positive oxygens from them. So we feel so good to stand in a greenery, so our child would feel that comfort and peace when they are suffering or they are a bit confused because of this all big jump in their life or totally new culture in the school. Yeah. So if they come to you, you should No, what is
so
your
here,
role?
Before yeah. you start doing the upbringing, you have to do your upbringing. You have to change.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah.
All right. So you're trying to say that once we come to know as parents, something is like happening like that, or a child himself or herself comes and tells this to the parent, a parent needs to listen to the child in a very calm mood.
Yeah. Because, you know, mostly what happens when, especially the new comers in a European society or in other countries, non-Muslim countries, when they listen to all these different issues, especially what happens in the school, the parents, they can't accept it. And straight away, they are the big, you know, objection, and they get very hyper and they say, no, it's haram and you cannot, you know, do this, do that. So just listen, just listen.
Don't be hyper.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that you are accepting everything, because we think, mostly parents, they think if I listen to my child very calmly, that means
I'm part of
that journey. Yeah. So inshallah, we are going to discuss more about this beautiful principle of upbringing, which is asl. This is asl, amn. Amn yani peace. Yeah, all this right. is the principle. Like, we should provide a very peaceful environment towards our child, inshallah.
Inshallah. We actually had an audience question regarding the same discussion, but I don't think we would be able to, you know, involve that question today in the session. Inshallah, I'll continue this session with you in another episode. Let me provide a little summary of what you said. You said so far that parents need to choose a school very, very wisely.
Definitely, yeah.
Not on the competitive basis. Like, if I see my relative going for some expensive school for his child, or my neighbor doing the same thing, I don't need to see those things and do competition myself. Thinking about the future of a child, I must choose widely. So I must choose wisely. So the first thing I can do is to select a good school, talk with the management, be in touch with the management, give management my conditions, that my conditions for my child are these. If you accept, then you do Bismillah. And if they do not accept, you go on changing the school. Thank you so much, Sister Najafi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.